Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, February 21st, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on national security leaks. My name is Christian Corgan, Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome Nathan Sales, Professor of Law at George Mason University School of Law, and Mr. Ben Weisner, Director of the Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project for the American Civil Liberties Union. A more complete bio for our speakers was provided to you in notice of the call, so I will stop there and preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. Professor Sales, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you all for being here today. I'd like to set forward the legal, both statutory and constitutional principles that that govern government employees who leak information about national security matters to the press. Before we do that, though, I think it's a good idea to have in mind a sense of the scope of the problem. Leaks are certainly nothing new. They've been with us since the dawn of the Republic, but people have been paying perhaps more attention to them in recent years. Just within the past couple of years, we've seen leaks of information about the identity of a Pakistani doctor who is said to have assisted the CIA in its hunt for bin Laden in Abbottabad, Pakistan. We've seen leaks about a plot by Al-Qaeda's Yemeni affiliate to bomb commercial airliners. We've seen leaks about the apparent role of the United States and Israel in preparing the Stuxnet and Flame computer viruses that evidently were designed to disable the Iranian regime's nuclear weapons programs. This is nothing new, but given some of the high-profile leaks that we've seen in recent years, both Congress, academics, and other commentators are starting to pay a bit more attention to this issue. So what can the government do about it? What should it do, and what is it constrained from doing by statutory law and by the Constitution? There's basically two broad classes of responses the government can follow. One is on the supply side and one is on the demand side. The supply side restrictions involve imposing limits on government employees' ability to leak. The demand side restrictions concern restrictions imposed on the press, seeking injunctive relief or criminal sanctions for newspapers or bloggers that publish classified information. I want to basically ignore the demand side problems and focus on the supply side problems in my comments, but I'm happy to get into Q&A later on in the call. So the legal principles, at least the statutory principles that govern leaks, are fairly straightforward. The leading and governing statute is the Espionage Act, a 1917 era statute. Yes, you heard that right. The leading statute is nearly 100 years old. It provides that it's a crime to willfully communicate, deliver, or transmit any information that relates to the national defense to any person who's not entitled to receive it, if the leaking official has reason to believe that the information could harm the United States or be used to the advantage of any foreign nation. So the Espionage Act, as you can imagine, quite plainly applies to spies who are working for the Soviet Union or China or any other foreign power. The key question for us is, to what extent does it also regulate leaks by government employees to the press or other non-foreign government sources? The leading case on this issue is U.S. versus Morrison, a Fourth Circuit case from back in 1984. Morrison was a U.S. Navy intelligence officer who obtained satellite imagery of a new Soviet aircraft carrier and then proceeded to give that imagery to Jane's Defense Weekly, a British military publication. He says he was trying to alert the public about alarming new Soviet military capabilities. It's more likely that he was angling for a job with the publication. The district court and then the Fourth Circuit concluded that Morrison's leak violated the Espionage Act. Despite the fact that Morrison was not a spy for a foreign government, he still fell within the scope of the statute. The reason the courts gave basically had to do with the plain language. The Espionage Act is written in fairly sweeping and broad terms. It doesn't say any person who leaks to a foreign government. It says any person who leaks to any person not entitled to receive it. So the courts reasoned, you know, Congress meant by this broad plain language to reach a large swath of unauthorized disclosures. The courts also pointed out the statutory purposes. Congress's goal in enacting the Espionage Act was to keep our nation's most sensitive secrets from falling into the hands of foreign adversaries. And the court pointed out, well, that harm obtains regardless of the means by which the foreign government gets the information. It doesn't matter whether they get the information wrapped in a brown paper envelope or whether they read about it on the front page of the Washington Post. They're still learning sensitive national security secrets. So what about the Constitution? Well, the First Amendment doesn't really have that much to say, I don't think, about statutory limits on the government's ability to prosecute leakers. I think the First Amendment has an awful lot to say when we talk about restrictions on the press, but I think the First Amendment problems are quite less problematic, less thorny when we talk about leakers like Morrison. The basic rationale that has emerged from a related series of cases is essentially a waiver or contract rationale. When a government employee goes to work for the government and gain access to classified information, they almost invariably sign non-disclosure agreements. They pledge not to reveal any classified information at all. They also pledge to submit any publications to their employer for review so the employer can scrub it for any possible classified information. And the Supreme Court in a series of cases has held that these contractual provisions don't really raise any overcome or don't really raise any difficult First Amendment problems. I think that's probably right. An employee who chooses to work for the government gains access to classified information as a condition of his employment, and as a condition of his employment, he expressly agrees to maintain the confidentiality. There's no evidence of coercion. There's no evidence of duress. These employees have plenty of opportunities elsewhere, so there's no reason to think that they entered into this secrecy pledge with anything but open mind and a clear conscience. So this is not to say that the Espionage Act is perfect, far from it. As I said, the statute dates from nearly a century ago. It was written in the time of the Spanish flu when the internet wasn't even a pipe dream. So not only is it badly outdated, some of the key terms of the statute are impossibly vague. So what exactly does it mean for information to, quote, relate to the national defense, and who is, quote, a person not entitled to receive it? So right now we have an imperfect system for resolving some of those statutory ambiguities, and the mechanism is basically jury instructions. Courts in Espionage Act prosecutions will typically instruct the jurors to adopt a narrower understanding of particular terms. That's better than nothing, but I think congressional action is preferable to a judicial remedy for a number of reasons, the first of which is adequacy of notice. Jury instructions can help exonerate a defendant who couldn't have anticipated reasonably that his conduct would run afoul of the statute. But ex post jury instructions don't really do much, if anything, to help government employees who want to avoid being charged in the first place. So I don't think that jury instructions provide adequate notice. And the other problem with an ex post remedy like this is that it's effectively a delegation. Congress effectively is delegating to courts the responsibility for determining key questions about the Espionage Act, such as its meaning, such as its scope, what types of conduct are sufficiently harmful that they should be proscribed by the criminal law. Call me old-fashioned, but I tend to think that these sorts of critical policy determinations should be made by Congress in conjunction with the president. That's all I have to say for now. I look forward to hearing what my counterpart has to say and look forward to some questions and answers afterwards.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Sales. We'll now move on to the opening statement by Mr. Wisner.
Thanks so much for including me in this discussion. I hope that I don't disappoint the audience by saying that I don't disagree with a single thing that Professor Sales just said, but I do predict that he won't be able to make the same comment at the conclusion of my remarks. But Professor Sales started by saying that the key statute here is the Espionage Act from 1917, and then went on to say that the first key judicial gloss on that with respect to leaks of the press was in 1984. Let me add to that, that as late as 1979, the general counsel of the CIA testified to Congress that he couldn't even say for certain whether leaks to the press were even prohibited by the act. He testified that if the Espionage Act made it a crime to disclose defense secrets to the press without any subversive intent, then, and I'm quoting here, "We have had in this country for the last 60 years an absolutely unprecedented crime wave, because surely there have been thousands upon thousands of unauthorized disclosures of classified information, all criminal acts in the Justice Department's view, and yet none has ever been prosecuted." Well, that last phrase we can't say anymore, because as you all know, there have been a series of prosecutions under the Espionage Act in the last decades, not so many, and in fact more under the Obama administration than in all of American history up until that point, but it's now certainly established in the lower courts, although not yet in the Supreme Court, that the Espionage Act can constitutionally be applied to criminalize leaks to the press. There are now, in fact, in Congress, proposals even to strengthen the anti-leaks laws. One of those proposals, for example, would limit who in the intelligence community is even allowed to speak to the press, and would require that only the heads of departments or public affairs be able to speak, and would cut off all mid-level employees and intelligence agencies from speaking to the press in an effort to close off unauthorized leaks. I would posit that those kinds of proposals are the wrong solution to the wrong problem. They're the wrong solution because they facilitate manipulation of the press. If only the top-level officials in an agency are allowed to speak to the press and not the mid-level ones, then only the party line generally will be leaked and will get one side of the story. And we saw something like that in the lead-up to the Iraq War, where the New York Times, which relied mainly on leaks from top-level officials, got large parts of the story wrong, whereas the Knight Ridder papers, who had sources embedded in the mid-levels of the defense and intelligence establishment, largely got the story right, although no one noticed. I say it's the wrong problem because, in my view, the problem is not that there are too many national security leaks, but that there are too few. And let me elaborate on that. I mean, I think that there is a massive amount of overclassification. Huge amounts of material that should not be kept secret are kept secret, and there's some consensus about that, although some disagreement about where those lines ought to be drawn. And in the face of that really intractable problem that's been talked about for decades but has only gotten worse and not better, national security leaks become a critical accountability mechanism. So, for example, without unauthorized leaks to the press, the American public never would have known about the torture of prisoners at Abu Ghraib, the CIA's network of secret prisons in Europe and elsewhere, the Department of Justice memos authorizing enhanced interrogation techniques, the National Security Agency's program of warrantless wiretapping that was of such concern to high-level members of the FBI and Department of Justice in the Bush administration that they threatened a mass resignation, and many other such programs and activities. Now, it may be that some people on this call are nodding and saying, good. but I would say that whatever you think about the legality and the efficacy and the morality of those programs, in a democracy, critical issues like those have to be debated publicly. And let me make one more point to frame what I hope will be an interesting discussion afterwards. In my view, the conflict over unauthorized leaks is not strictly or even fundamentally about secrecy versus transparency. It's also about power and accountability. So it's not just about what information is released to the public and when and in what contexts. It's about what kinds of legal challenges involving secret programs can be heard by courts. And an example that I think everyone on this call will be familiar with is the current debate about drones and targeted killing. In early 2010, in a series of obviously coordinated leaks, the Obama administration told the press that it had targeted U.S. citizen Anwar al-Awlaki for assassination, targeted killing, whatever word you want to use. And these leaks were obviously authorized and coordinated because they appeared in major newspapers at the same time. And I don't know what the political reason was for the Obama administration to make the decision to leak that information, but they did make that decision. Just a few months later, in response to a lawsuit brought by the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights, intended to set legal limits on the executive branch's authority to use targeted killing, the administration invoked the state secrets privilege, saying that the identity of targets, et cetera, all of these things could not be revealed to the public without harm to national security. And just a few months after that, in response to a FOIA request that we filed about the targeted killing program, the CIA invoked the so-called Glomar defense, saying that they could not confirm or deny the existence of any responsive records without harm to national security. And even now, 3 years later, that continues to be the position of the CIA, that even to acknowledge whether they have a drone or targeted killing program would harm national security. You know, I had a chance to ask John Brennan in a talk that he gave at Harvard. I stood at the microphone and my question was, do the CIA have a drone program? And his answer was, you know, if the CIA has such a program, I can assure you that it complies with all legal obligations. And there was a lot of laughter in the room in response to that. But at the end of the day, it's not funny when the top terrorism advisor to the president can't acknowledge what the entire world already knows. And I would posit that, again, that has nothing to do with secrecy, so to speak. Everyone knows that the program exists. It has to do with control of how the information can be used, because if the CIA were to acknowledge that it had a program, then it would be harder for them to dismiss lawsuits brought by victims and others seeking to explore the legality of some of those practices. Let me just wrap up by saying that I acknowledge that there are some very, very difficult legal issues at stake here, and I am not advocating a system that would allow each of the 3 or 4 million people who have security clearances to decide for himself or herself, based on his or her own judgment, what information should be secret and what information must be public. That's not a sustainable system. The flip side, though, is that a system in which each of those people wielding a classification stamp can decide what information about war and peace, about illegality, about scandal, will be brought before the public or kept secret, doesn't strike me as ultimately sustainable in a democracy either, where these issues do need to be publicly debated. And I don't oppose the idea suggested by Professor Sales that Congress, in theory, should take a fresh look at this. I probably am more nervous than he about what the outcome of that fresh look would be in the current climate. But I agree that the Espionage Act is enigmatic and doesn't answer some of the most difficult questions that we have in this area. So thank you, and I look forward to a discussion.
Fantastic. This is Christian Corrigan again. We appreciate that. I will now open the floor to your questions. In a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a second prompt that will say your microphone has been turned on, you have the floor. We'll be answering questions in the order in which they are received. While we're waiting, I want to do two things. The first is to remind you that our next scheduled Teleform conference call will be tomorrow, Friday, February 22nd, from 2 to 3 p.m., when we will host a discussion on, is American justice blind or blind to a prosecutorocracy, featuring Lord Conrad Black, Professor William Otis, and Professor Ellen Podger. While we're waiting for the questions to come in, Professor Sales, do you want to take a couple minutes to respond?
And thanks. Yes, very much. I would like that very much. And thank you to Mr. Wisner for that thoughtful and thought-provoking commentary. I want to engage on the point that leaks are a remedy to overclassification and an important accountability mechanism. So as a scholar of national security law, I make my living based on leaks. If it's not in the newspaper, I don't have anything to write a law review article about. But I think that treating leaks as an accountability mechanism is misguided. Let me say just a couple of things about why I think that's so. First of all, let's spend a little bit of time thinking about the harm of leaks when they take place. Some leaks can have beneficial corrective purposes. So the Abu Ghraib leaks, for instance, allowed Congress and the administration to put an end to ghastly abuse of prisoners. But other leaks are much more harmful, such as revelations about the U.S. SWIFT financial tracking program. There were no indications that the U.S. program to track terrorist finances through the Belgian Interbank Consortium violated any principles of statutory law or constitutional law, but the press still saw fit to publish it. The stories about Stuxnet and Flame, again, these there's no indication of abuse, wrongdoing, violations of statutes, violations of the Constitution, and yet those stories are gratuitously leaked and then reported. Leaks can be good ways to deter wrongdoing, but too many of the leaks that we grapple with have nothing to do with allegations of wrongdoing at all. It's also important to keep in mind that leaks are not the only and maybe even not the most effective form of accountability. Since the 1970s and the Church Commission reports, the intelligence community has been comprehensively reorganized by Congress to allow for internal reporting and internal whistleblowing. Sometimes those mechanisms work better than they should, or not as well as they should, but it's not often the case that the only recourse for an employee who has discovered wrongdoing is to tell the New York Times about it. There are opportunities to report up the chain of command, to tell independent investigators within your agency, to go to the House and Senate Intelligence Committees as well. So it's actually bicameral and bi-branch accountability and oversight. Finally, I want to embrace a point that Mr. Wisner made at the end, which is that a system wouldn't be sustainable if individual employees were responsible for deciding what should be publicized and what shouldn't. And this, is, I think, is where I'll renew my call for congressional action. There is overclassification. It's not up to individual employees to blow the whistle on that, however. It's up to Congress. I think Congress plainly has statutory and constitutional role to play in determining what information is properly classified and what is not. And I think congressional action is far preferable to that of individual employees precisely because of accountability. If Congress is responsible for determining what is classifiable and what is not, the public can participate in that debate in an open and transparent way, and that simply doesn't happen if individual employees take it upon themselves to decide this should be classified or this should be leaked.
This is Christian Corgan. Thank you, Professor Sales. We're going to go ahead and move to the first question. Again, to ask a question, please press the star button and then the pound key. Once you hear the prompt, your microphone has been turned on. You have the floor. You may ask your question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Let's go over the clauses in the Constitution that might provide some authority for legislation in this area. Number one, we have the authority to discipline the military and the militia when in federal service. But by our original understanding of those words, that would not include civilian personnel of the government. So unless we were to bring all civilian personnel and perhaps contractors into the military, that clause wouldn't cover them. We have the provision for removal of officials for treason, bribery, or high crimes and misdemeanors, but only authority to punish for treason among those, not for bribery and high crimes and misdemeanors, which would include the offenses of officials. But it extends only to military personnel. Then we have the possibility of acts committed on federal enclave territory, like the District of Columbia, where the federal government has the broader authorities of a state. Under treason, there is authority to punish it. It can include giving aid and comfort to an enemy, but it doesn't give the authority to declare to the president who an enemy is. It reserves that power to Congress. So unless Congress issues a declaration of war or letters of marked reprisal, no enemy is legally defined. There's a clause against piracy. Piracy can be construed as a warlike act by a non-state actor, but it has to be against an asset of a nation other than his own. And finally, we have the problem that classification itself runs into conflict with what might be regarded as the Ninth Amendment right to have the means to supervise our public servants, get reports to get disclosure of their expenditures and activities so that they may be held accountable, as has been pointed out. So there appears to be no constitutional authority for most of what the Espionage Act does, or for most of the threatened prosecutions against leakers, especially those who merely receive leaked information.
Professor Sales, do you want to address that point?
Yeah, you know, I don't really know that it's controversial to say that Congress, which after all has the authority to establish the military and the intelligence community, lacks the authority to specify what shall be done with information generated by the military and the intelligence community. I think Congress's powers to create the armed forces, coupled with the necessary and proper clause, coupled with a variety of other constitutional provisions, provide adequate constitutional support for Congress's authority to establish rules governing what government employees will do with information that the government has chosen to entrust them with. Now, the constitutional problems associated with imposing limits on the press, outsiders, I think are considerably more thorny, but I don't see much of a problem with Congress establishing rules governing government employees.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps we'll have a question later on that allows us to explore the First Amendment dimensions of, say, a prosecution of WikiLeaks or Julian Assange, but I don't have any comment on the general constitutional authority for Congress to legislate in this area.
This is Jack Park. Thanks, guys. Just a question about a recent prosecution. It's my understanding that the CIA employee, is his name Kiriakou, was recently convicted or sentenced. Do we know, was the prosecution brought under the Espionage Act, or do we know whether any of the issues that you guys have flagged were raised in that prosecution? Thank you.
This is Ben Weisner. I mean, my understanding is that was a guilty plea, and Nathan, please correct me if I'm wrong about this, that he was prosecuted both under the Espionage Act and under the Intelligence Identities Protection Act, but it might just have been the latter. So there was no trial in this case in which the main issues that we've discussed today could be litigated.
Yeah, this is Nathan Sales. That's my understanding as well, that there were a number of statutes, including the Espionage Act. And, yeah, that's my understanding.
Thank you.
Great. Well, we'll move on to our next question.
Hi, this is Matthew Rackety from Pace Law School. This question is directed to both speakers, although in particular Mr. Weisner. Just thinking from a political philosophy perspective, I realize that it sort of is a value, or like a fundamental value of the democratic system and in the United States Republican government to have open and free debate in the public. But with regards to state secrets and things along that line, I'm wondering why there isn't, or I'd like to suggest that there could be a practical necessity to have certain controls, both within the executive and the legislative, to control information, at least temporarily, when it concerns a particular security threats, and perhaps even in other arenas, that tends to be controlled somehow. And I think the media generally, a free press, does a good job of acting as a check on that. But just speaking from a political philosophy perspective, I'm wondering if you think a system where everything is free and open would truly be sustainable in a democratic system where the flux of public opinion would really kind of work to, I think, confound the ability to make effective policy. Although we do definitely want public aspect brought in.
Ben, you want to take a crack at that? I'm sorry.
Sure. Why don't I first, because he directed it first to me, and I'm sure we'll both want to address this one. I actually think it's a very good statement of the conflict in that question. That from a political philosophy standpoint, the ideal is a government that's transparent and a citizenry that has privacy. And the opposite of that is a government that's secret and a citizenry that is surveilled. Having said that, I absolutely acknowledge that some secrets are valid. I don't believe that all information must be free and that every government activity must be made public. And, clear examples of that are, the technology behind signals intelligence, the identity of undercover operatives, which if disclosed can lead to their death, troop movements in war. There are more examples. But I think that the harms that have come from excessive secrecy far outweigh in our history the harms that have come from releases. Everyone recalls the Pentagon Papers case where the Solicitor General stood before the Supreme Court and presented the affidavits of intelligence officials that there would be grave harm to national security if the papers were published. That Solicitor General, Erwin Griswold, wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post 2 decades later saying that he had never seen a shred of a suggestion that there had been any harm to national security from the publication of those papers. So sure, it ends up being a difficult balance sometimes, and I don't mean to suggest that the government doesn't have a legitimate need to protect secrets in some circumstances. I would just say that if we only measure the harm caused by particular releases of secrets and don't weigh into that equation, the harm to our system and in times to national security as well from excessive classification, that we're misbalancing that equation. And just one final point. I think the leaks about Stuxnet, which Professor Sales mentioned, are sort of exactly at that point of tension. Because one could understand why, certainly before the attack on the Iranian nuclear facilities was conducted using this tool, there might be a need for secrecy. At the same time, the United States may have unleashed a whole new weapon of war that is the kind of authority that, at least in broad terms, does need to be debated by the public. Should we be using offensive cyber attacks against other countries? What are the consequences of that? If we're the first country in the world to have done that, do the benefits outweigh the harms in introducing this new era in cyber warfare? That to me is a difficult one because I do think that there does have to be a public debate about that, and I think that that congressional oversight, flawed or not flawed, is not sufficient in that case.
Thank you. I agree with Ben that look, this is there's an enduring tension here between openness and secrecy, and it's one that this country has dealt with since the very beginning. I mean, remember, the Constitution itself was drafted behind closed doors. The sentiment was we there's certain things that are eventually fit for public consumption, but the glare of publicity during their formative phases can be disastrous. I don't think it's possible to answer the question in the abstract, should we have more openness or should we have more protection for national security secrets? It's very much a case-by-case determination. And the what makes it even more difficult is what one person sees as a leak designed to prevent abuses or lawlessness, another person will see as a leak that has just blown an incredibly important operation. I think a great example of that is the terrorist surveillance program. Depending on who you ask, it's either our most effective tool for eavesdropping on al-Qaeda members as they plot their dastardly deeds, or it was the second coming of J. Edgar Hoover with the government snooping around in everybody's electronic inboxes. Those cases are very difficult because they present precisely that tension between the need to check government overreach and also the need to preserve sources and methods. But I don't think many of the leaks that have drawn public attention lately fall into that category. For instance, the SWIFT leak, which I mentioned a moment ago, there's no allegation that the Treasury Department is violating the Constitution in gaining access to information about international money transfers. There's no allegation that the Treasury Department is violating statutes, regulations, or any other operative legal principle. And yet, government employees still deem that to be newsworthy. Well, I think it's up to Congress to determine what's newsworthy, and the way Congress should do that is by specifying more clearly what the classification standards properly are, and we shouldn't really be leaving it to individual employees to strike that balance between openness and transparency. That is, on the one hand, and national security secrecy on the other. To the extent that, I mean, precisely because that is a question of utmost importance that deserves to be aired in public. I don't trust individual bureaucrats to make that call themselves.
Just one quick follow-up, just kind of throw a realist side into it. Because it is an abstract discussion, to the extent that Congress would try to get a general answer on how to, I mean, they could take it on a case-by-case basis, but I'm wondering, practically speaking, if it doesn't always have to, when it comes to new issues, always sort of fall on the individual employee and fall within a certain discretionary zone, some discretion of the executive or the key players involved in an issue as to whether or not to leak it because they feel that there's a public interest at stake. And then again, here I suppose it really speaks to the need to have a competent and ethical civil service and government and leadership and so on, if that makes sense.
Yes, this is Ben. I think so. I mean, I think at the end of the day, we're not going to be able to take away the role of courts in employing protective instructions, discretion, and even some constitutional standards. That doesn't mean that Congress couldn't be more granular in the distinctions that it draws. And here's where probably Professor Sales and I might part ways. But Congress could say, for example, that if other channels have proven inadequate, that leaks involving government fraud or illegality would be held to a different standard than leaks that don't involve fraud and illegality. I by the way, agree that there should be much, much better alternatives to leaking to the press than there are. I'm not confident that those alternatives will ever be improved enough to be adequate. Sometimes because employees in the executive branch are punished and retaliated against for going to Congress, even though they shouldn't be, and sometimes because Congress simply has fallen down on the job and not done a good enough job with its oversight, and it's only when something appears, in the newspaper and is brought to the general public that you see a remedy for it. But I do think Congress certainly could draw some clearer lines. But yes, at the end of the day, there's going to be a lot of judgment involved. And we're going to weigh the value of the information that was leaked, the harm to national security that was caused, the intent of the leaker, whether the information disclosed was about crimes committed by the government. All of those things will certainly bear on what we think about the value of those leaks. You know, whether the law can incorporate those distinctions, I think, is a trickier question.
Professor Sales, do you have anything else to add?
No, I don't.
Well, we have one more question on the line. Again, if you'd like to request the floor, please press star and then the pound key. We'll move on to our next question.
Yes, my name is Laura Tripoli. I just have one question. Has the media ever been held accountable for any classified information that they may have reported to the public?
Well,
Nathan, you want to start?
This is Nathan. Yeah, let me take a stab at that. The government tried in the Pentagon Papers case, but wasn't very successful. And there have been there were efforts after World War II to hold a Chicago newspaper accountable after it leaked information about the Navy's Signals Intelligence Corps breaking the principal Japanese operative code before the Battle of Midway. That's actually why Midway went so well, is because we had broken the code and were able to listen in on their planning before the Battle of Midway. To my knowledge, no blogger, no newspaper reporter, no newspaper itself has ever faced criminal liability or has been the product or been the target of successful injunctive relief. The Pentagon Papers case is actually very interesting on that question. The Pentagon Papers case is usually understood as, you know, a great victory for the freedom of the press, and in a sense it is, but if you actually go through the opinion with a fine-tooth comb and start counting noses, you see that the court comes out in unexpected ways. You have a couple members of the court signing on to the proposition that if Congress had enacted legislation affirmatively authorizing the president to seek judicial relief in joining the publication of the Pentagon Papers, that would be a different case. And you have a different coalition of justices saying, well, this is injunctive relief and prior restraints are subject to the most rigorous scrutiny under the First Amendment. However, the First Amendment might well permit Congress to criminalize newspaper publication of classified information. So there are hints lurking in the opinion that Congress could, if it wanted to, criminalize newspaper publication of classified information, or perhaps authorize injunctive relief. Congress has never taken those justices up on the implicit invitation, so we don't really have a lot of a track record here to comment on.
This is Ben. Just to add to that, I agree with everything that Nathan said. There hasn't been a prosecution of the press to date. It's not clear to me that there couldn't be one under the text of the Espionage Act, whether you would even need a new statute in order to do it. And I think that what has prevented any prosecution of the press has been some strategy. You know, during World War II, at least, the government didn't want to prosecute the Chicago Tribune because they didn't want to alert the enemies that the codes had been broken. And then also a kind of consensus. You know, there has been this idea that, for the most part, the American press, when they get national security leaks, will go to the administration that's in power and sit down and have a conversation. The New York Times does this. The Washington Post does this. Almost all U.S. publications do this. They will ultimately often disagree about what should or should not be published or when, but that consultation takes place. You know, I think the rise of WikiLeaks and maybe similar kinds of publishers will put that kind of consensus under strain. You know, at least at the beginning, WikiLeaks didn't follow that practice. They do it now. They have been, you know, offering to meet with officials to talk about what should or should not be published and make redactions. But I do think that consensus is under strain. And so if there were to be an indictment or a prosecution of WikiLeaks, it would be interesting to see if the government were able to distinguish what WikiLeaks has done from what The Guardian or what The New York Times or what Bob Woodward or other publications that, you know, that seek out national security secrets and publish them do, and how a court would consider the First Amendment implications of that kind of prosecution.
Yeah, if I could just follow up on that, I think the WikiLeaks case would be a fantastic test case, but we're probably not going to see it turn into one. If you'll recall, when the WikiLeaks story first broke, some time ago, the government announced that it was commencing an investigation, and the investigation seemed to look for evidence that WikiLeaks had affirmatively solicited Bradley Manning to collect the information and release it to them, as opposed to Manning being sort of a free agent who independently collated the information and then sent it off to WikiLeaks. And, you know, the implicit theory there was, we want to go after WikiLeaks not for a freestanding violation of the Espionage Act, but for conspiracy to violate other provisions of the Espionage Act. So it's interesting that the government's theory of the investigation reflected this sort of deep ambivalence about whether the Espionage Act would apply to an outside journalistic organization like a newspaper or a blog or WikiLeaks. And a reluctance to sort of push the envelope and test, you know, the outer bounds of how far the Espionage Act could reach and what the constitutional limits are.
This is Christian Corrigan. Our lines are open. If you have a question, please press star and then the pound key. We do have a few more minutes left on the call. While we're waiting, speaking of WikiLeaks, I mean, do either of you want to just give a brief framework, possibly for the First Amendment implications? I know it was briefly discussed at several points, but does anyone want to discuss that just briefly, and maybe have a chance for a response as well?
Nathan, you want to take a first crack at it?
Yeah, sure. Do you mean Christian? Do you mean the First Amendment principles that govern restrictions on newspapers?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. So the leading case is the Pentagon Papers case, I think. The Pentagon Papers case arose when, as Ben mentioned earlier, the government sought to enjoin the New York Times and then later the Washington Post from publishing information about the Vietnam War. It was depicted at the time. The government represented at the time that it was, you know, very, very serious stuff that had to be kept under wraps. Turns out it was pretty anodyne, innocuous stuff. It wasn't sources and methods. It wasn't operational details. It was sort of a historical account of the U.S. involvement in Southeast Asia, which tells us something about how much weight we should give to heat-of-the-moment representations from the government about likely harms. So, sometimes leaks will result in severe harms, but sometimes leaks don't really result in much harm at all, which I think is an important point to keep in mind. So the Pentagon Papers case involved a request for a prior restraint, as distinct from after publication criminal sanctions being imposed on the press. A badly fractured court couldn't agree on much, but they did agree that the prior restraint was invalid. So the basic rules that emerge from the Pentagon Papers case, as I read it, is prior restraints against the press bear a heavy presumption of invalidity. You can only, consistent with the First Amendment, you can only obtain a prior restraint to prevent the publication of information such as sailing dates for ships, troop movements, things like that. On the other hand, you also see a strain in the opinion in which a number of justices say no prior restraint under current law because Congress hasn't authorized it. However, if Congress were to enact such a statute, that would be a much closer case. And the reason for that is basically the application of the famous steel seizure concurrence from Justice Jackson to First Amendment law. The implicit idea, I think, that these justices were playing with is the president doesn't have the inherent authority on his own to prevent the press from publishing information. But if Congress's powers are conjoined with the president may have that authority in certain circumstances. So that's sort of the Supreme Court's first and to this date still most compelling word on the subject.
And this is Ben. I would only add to that that to me it's never really made sense that if the Constitution prohibits prior restraint on the publication of particular information, that it might also permit criminal prosecution for the publication of that same information. That if criminal prosecution were available in those instances, the kind of self-censorship, the kind of chilling effect that would be created would amount to a kind of backdoor prior restraint, and that the law can't really, in my mind, sort of rationally distinguish between those. Now, you could make an argument that certain categories of information can be both restrained and punished if published, but that distinction hasn't made a lot of sense to me, and and the better practice and lesser evil is to exempt publishers from criminal jeopardy for publishing information that's truthful and lawfully obtained.
This is Christian Corgan. Our lines are open, so if you have, we've probably got time for at least one more question. While we're waiting, I do want to announce again that our next Teleforum conference call is tomorrow, Friday, February 22nd, from 2 to 3 p.m., a discussion on Is American Justice Blind or Blind to a Prosecutocracy? We also have one on Monday, February 25th at 2 p.m., a discussion on gun control, assessing constitutionality and effectiveness, featuring Jonathan Lowy and John G. Malcolm. But it looks like we do not have any more questions. We do have a couple minutes here at the end of the call. I'd like to give both of our speakers an opportunity to offer some concluding thoughts to round out our call. Professor Sales, would you like to begin?
Sure. Excuse me. Sure. Yeah. I just go back to something that Ben and I have both danced around, and that is there are often many times there are not going to be easy ways to resolve these very difficult questions. National security leaks implicate two very profound values that are often in tension with one another. On the one hand, we have our foundational commitment to openness and transparency, and the public cannot deliberate about national security policy or check government overreaches and abuses unless it has access to information. But on the other side of the ledger, we have an equally compelling need to maintain secrecy about certain information that should be secret, the names of spies, the sources and methods we use to eavesdrop on Al-Qaeda members, the tools we use to track how Al-Qaeda finances its operations, and so on. This is an enduring tension that's been with us since the very beginning of the country, and it's not going to go away anytime soon. The best we can do, I think, is to try and apply these values, which are often in tension with one another in a particular case, in a way that serves to do justice to them both.
Thanks for those remarks, and thanks again for this discussion. I think it's always a pleasure to participate in Federalist Society events because you bring people from across the spectrum and you find, as you have today, that there's often a fair amount of common ground in these kinds of discussions. Let me just draw an analogy here that might even lead to a topic for a future discussion. I think the debate about leaking parallels in some ways the debate that we're seeing now about hacking. In particular, since the suicide of Aaron Swartz, who was being prosecuted for hacking into the JSTOR database. We know intuitively that not all hackers are the same. We feel differently about Chinese hackers who are using corporate espionage to steal business secrets, or criminal hackers who are stealing millions of credit cards. That's not the same as an idealistic kid hacking into Pacer because he doesn't think that the public should have to pay for access to judicial records. Similarly with leaks, we do think that there is a difference between Daniel Ellsberg Xeroxing documents in a house in Santa Monica and giving them to the New York Times and someone selling secrets to China. It's not so easy to write laws that distinguish between those kinds of situations, and we end up falling back again and again on prosecutorial discretion. And I do think that that's regrettable in some ways, but also that in a lot of cases, I think prosecutors, have made the right decisions. What we don't want to see is that because of how difficult it is to catch hackers and to catch leakers, that prosecutors use the wrong cases in order to set examples, in order to deter others. We want to make sure that prosecutors are using the ample power that they have to make reasoned and value-based judgments about how much society should punish, different kinds of violations of these laws.
This is Christian Corrigan. Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank both our experts today. Thank you to our audience for calling in and taking the time out of your days. We welcome feedback on this call to info@fedsoc.org. Please do join us tomorrow, February 22nd, from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern for our next call, and we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.